Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please support the restoration, the preservation, and the presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma with your donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. Tonight's talk is similar to last Saturday's talk, in that it's on dependent origination and how a particular theme of the Buddha's Dhamma relates to dependent origination. And so beginning four or five classes ago, we had a class on the Salatha Sutta, which shows how a mind reacting out of ignorance distracts itself from what's occurring and inflicts ever more stress and suffering on itself out of that ignorance. Then we looked at the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, where the Buddha teaches that wrong views of self are maintained by something called five clinging aggregates. That's the ongoing vehicle for the personal experience of suffering, five clinging aggregates. And what the Buddha is teaching in that sutta is that the views that we're holding of a self are wrong views. They're anatta. They don't accurately describe a human being. Let go of the views. And you could say that's the essence of the Buddha's Dhamma, to recognize and abandon all views ignorant of Four Noble Truths. And because of that ignorance, we start conditioning our minds, this was last Saturday's talk, towards maintaining that ignorance. It's a nature of ignorance. Excuse me for a moment. Thank you, Matt. It's the nature of ignorance to ignore ignorance. It's included in the root of the word. Ignorance requires continued ignorance. It requires human beings to ignore their own ignorance. And we've created very powerful and very subtle strategies to maintain that ignorance. And in a very broad and general way, you could take all of those very powerful and very subtle strategies used to maintain wrong views of self and call them the non-dual myth. Because every fabrication of self hopes to resolve itself in some fabricated, speculative, non-physical existence. And we can go down the whole list, and I probably will eventually, but there's hardly a religion, including pagan religions. The reason why I said is many people think pagan is more of a natural religion or an understanding of the natural world, but its results are the same. It's a speculative result. And so I don't think anybody could point out to me a religion that doesn't have some component of non-duality as the resolution for fabricated views of self. In Buddhism, it might be Tulsi to heaven, or Abhidhamma, or Amitabha Buddha heaven. It might be simply the repository in nothingness or emptiness, which is taught as the goal for a lot of Buddhism, or even religions such as Christian religions, where it's heaven, and most religions have some connotation of that. That is a non-dual establishment. It's the one thing that the Buddha recognized and abandoned immediately upon his awakening. Remember, he studied the common so-called religions and spiritual philosophies of his time, and they all resolved themselves in one way or another into some non-physical, non-dual, we are all one resolution. So I'm not going to read the article because, like I said Saturday, it would be like commenting on my comments, but I'm going to reference it and then explain what I mean in a little bit more detail, because this really is it really is the essence of the Buddha's Dhamma, is recognizing there's nothing non-dual about anything in the world except some very practical matters. I might as well say what they are. We're, for all practical purposes related to the Dhamma, non-duality is a continuing distraction that does not support the Dhamma. There are arguments to be made that there's connections between human beings in the physical world. Carl Sagan, I always think we used to say that we're made up of star stuff, billions and billions of stars. Well, it's true. There's essence of the stars, physical essence of the stars in each and every human being. But that doesn't mean that as Dhamma practitioners, we're connected in the Dhamma. It just means an expression of or an acknowledgement of what it means to live in the physical world. So in the physical world, all things are connected by their physicality. But all things are disjoined by their wrong views. And so if we really hope to strive for something that might seem like a non-dual, or at least a non-competitive way of living in the world, a non-aggressive way of living in the world, we'll realize our discreteness, that each and every human being is individual, and each and every object in the universe is an individual object, and let that be. Imagine if we could do that. Except we're so unsure of ourselves and so full of self-loathing that we apply that to other people. And since I don't know what I am, you can't know what you are. And we get into this this collective soup of trying to find a repository for our own ignorance. And that repository is always some type of non-dual, non-physical, speculative existence. Always. The dependent origination states, from fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. That's the first step in the 12-link chain of dependencies. A fabrication is another word for a corruption. So what we're doing is we're fabricating our understanding of who we are in relation to the world based on a lack of evidence of what's occurring in the world, meaning as described as Four Noble Truths. So from fabrications, from a misunderstanding of Four Noble Truths, from those fabrications as a requisite condition, that's an important line, that's in every one of these lines, for fabrication to occur, for the stress and suffering that results from that, there's a required condition. And if we can eliminate that required condition, all stress and suffering falls aside. And that required condition begins in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The next section of that, the next clinging portion of the 12-link chain of dependencies is from that consciousness as a requisite condition, meaning a consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. This isn't some grand cosmic consciousness. Again, see the fallacy of that non-dual myth. There is no such thing as a grand cosmic consciousness as far as human beings are concerned, as far as awakening is concerned. I want to know what it means to be a human being. Most of my life, I was chasing after what it meant to be a cosmic being. And it wasn't until I came to the realization until I came to the Buddha's Dhamma that I came to that most profound realization. I'm a human being, not a cosmic being. So let me find out what it means to be a human being first. And then if I find myself as a cosmic being, I'll get into that. As a consciousness, as from consciousness as a requisite condition, comes name and form. In Nepali, that's nama rupa. It simply means just that, not name and form. It means that I've given a name to this form. And that name is me. I've begun the process, rooted in the fabrication of Four Noble Truths, of self-identification with what? Look at the process. With my thinking. And because it's my thinking that I fabricated, I'm the only one that can change it. And anything that threatens that is perceived as a threat to me. I take it personally. We say all the time, the key to the Dhamma is not taking anything personally. This idea of recognizing the perniciousness and the cruelty of a non-dual myth is why I say this is so key. Because we'll stop doing it. And we'll stop doing it because we realize how foolish and hurtful it is to ourselves to keep recreating this or giving credence to it in any way, as Dhamma practitioners. I'm not, the whole world is, it can go ahead and they will continue to believe in non-physical, non-dual self-establishments. That certainly doesn't mean it's true, does it? It's just what the Buddha awakened to. From name and form, from self-identification, as a requisite condition comes the sixth sense base. Notice the progression. The Buddha is not saying that because of ignorance, we have a sixth sense base. He's describing this within the context of having a human life. Ignorance is a given. From ignorance, fabrications are a given. From fabrications, a consciousness rooted in that ignorance are a given. From that given comes self-identification with that consciousness. From that type of consciousness, I'm now giving validity to my six senses, my five physical senses and the sixth sense consciousness. So they're always prevalent, aren't they? As a consequence of being a human being, I have this sixth sense base. When that sixth sense base is informed by ignorance rather than wisdom, what does it do? It's feeding back on me that ignorance, because that's what I'm clinging to. That's the consciousness that I'm clinging to. Does anybody have any questions at this point? No? Everybody's following me, the progression from ignorance to where we are now?
Yes.
To the sixth sense base? So I'm a, what's the right word? I was going to say a wide awake human being, but not in the terms of the Dhamma. I'm just a functioning human being. But I'm not aware of what I've done to myself, meaning I have not educated myself on Four Noble Truths. So all of my perceptions and fabrications that I'm creating about the world are rooted in that ignorance. And now I'm using my senses to validate and reaffirm that. Do you see how now everything that comes into my sixth sense base, everything that I come in contact with, which is the next step, can only reaffirm ignorance and cannot deliver me any type of salvation, not that the Buddha's Dhamma is salvation. It cannot deliver me any type of understanding. Ignorance and wisdom cannot coincide. The Buddha's Dhamma, we had an interesting little talk with Tim about this on Saturday. The Buddha's Dhamma is to be recognized. Ignorance is to be recognized and abandoned. Tim brought up the reconciliation part. That's the reconciliation. It's not just recognition of ignorance. It's the intentional and conscious act of recognizing it and immediately abandoning it. That's the reconciliation of ignorance. That's how we do it within the Dhamma. Okay. From the sixth sense base as a requisite condition comes contact. Makes sense? I'm now informing my senses to ignorance. And as I come in contact with the world, I'm reaffirming that ignorance, no matter what it is. And so if I decide that I want a spiritual, philosophical, or religious aspect to my life, then I'm going to seek out a religion, a spiritual belief, or a philosophical system that reaffirms my confirmation bias, my bias towards ignorance. And so we've created beautiful, wonderful, and scary religions and philosophical and spiritual systems as the provider for that speculation. Is everybody following me?
Yes.
Does everybody agree with me? You don't have to, by the way. Does everybody agree with me? You better. I mean, I said you don't have to, but it's good that you do. And so from contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. And how many times do we describe ourselves to others and to ourselves who we are based on how we feel? But the feeling, every feeling is temporary. And in fact, if we saw them that way, we would experience every feeling as immediately temporary. And we would stay present with it only as long as it was appropriate. In other words, feelings are not good or bad. It's what we do with them. And if we're interpreting feelings from ignorance, they're bad because they only reaffirm that ignorance. From that feeling as a requisite condition, a feeling rooted in a fabrication as a requisite condition, comes craving. Why? Why does a feeling contribute to craving? Brett, I want to call you Bert.
Because you just want it to be different.
Yes, and in the sense of craving, well, I want more. Mm-hmm. And we call that a feeling. And sometimes you might describe that feeling as grasping, as anxious. It might be fearful that I'm not going to get that second cake, piece of chocolate cake. But the feeling is the same. It doesn't matter the label we put. Once we have the feeling of wanting more or less of something, we've literally, and as far as the Dhamma is concerned, we've lost our mind. But can you see how clearly that's a good explanation of losing our mind? Because now I'm into a piece of chocolate cake as my fulfillment. That's losing your mind, isn't it? As a human being, to decide that in this moment I need a chocolate cake or another kiss or a better conversation or a different president or a different senator or a different virus or a different this or a different that, I've lost my mind. And once I do it once, it becomes so useful and effective of distracting me, I'm going to continue to do it. I will become addicted to what I found directs me away from my own ignorance. That's the nature of addiction. Some people crawl into a vodka bottle. Some people do other things. They might kick the dog or spend too much time on Facebook or Twitter or spend too much time golfing. I know a few people like that. We'll create very powerful and very subtle strategies. Most of the strategies are accepted by the people we're in contact with in society as a whole. Very powerful, very subtle, very acceptable strategies to continue our ignorance. I wrote a series of articles a few months ago about how nothing has changed over the years in relation to current events, but nothing has changed at all in the course of human events. Nothing. The problem is still ignorance. Ignorance has not been resolved, so there's no reconciliation. Thanks for that, Tim, that fine point. And so there can't be, and there never will be. The universe, and now let's bring it back to something not quite as non-dual, the Earth, our planet, where we live, is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It's a planet and a plane of existence that is prone to birth, sickness, aging, and death. It's a plane of existence that is prone to not getting what is desired for its inhabitants. And it's a plane of existence that's prone to getting what is undesired for its inhabitants. And guess what? All of those inhabitants can be clearly described as five clinging aggregates. Do you see how it follows through these all these talks we're describing now and explaining? And now we're here. We've brought the five clinging aggregates, this personal experience of suffering, into Dhamma practice. And I'm starting to now get a glimpse that all of those imaginary self-establishments that I've required for myself, a requisite condition, including the fabricated imaginary self-establishment that I need another chalk piece of chocolate cake right now to be happy, is the same as saying if I do all these things right, I can end up in Tulsita Buddhist heaven when I'm dead. I've lost my mind about throwing myself into the future about getting a piece of cake. Excuse me. And I've lost my mind just as much about living my life now so I can get a reward when I'm dead. Does everybody see that as the same speculation? The same fabrication? It's if any time we try to establish ourselves in our imagination, we've lost our mind. And we do that every time we say, I need more or I need less of something, which is just two sides of the same coin of craving and clinging. Everybody's clear on that? From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. So again, let's look at the simple process here. I crave for something, I finally get it, and now I got to have it. That's clinging and maintaining. I attach myself to that. And it's not just chocolate cake. In fact, if it was just chocolate cake, the Dhamma would be a piece of cake. How's that? It's really the thoughts that we cling to that are our chocolate cake. That's what we ultimately can't let go of. Why? Why is it so hard for me to let go of a thought?
Because it becomes your identity?
But yes, because I had the thought. And because I think that I am all that there is, how can I let go of even one thought? No matter how ridiculous or painful that thought, no matter how much pain or ridiculous scenarios that thought might put me in. It's my thought. I'm not going to let it go. And we do that in extreme cases, but we do it in very subtle things. If I don't get that second piece of chocolate cake, I'm not going to sleep well. Yeah.
Sorry.
All right.
So it's even that the addiction is self-establishment. The addiction is self-identification with thought.
Exactly. It's with the thought. So... And there's a physical component of this, but then I'll use my alcoholism because it's just a good example and I know it well. So there's a physical component to being addicted to alcohol. That if you just stop drinking in 3 days, there's no more physical component. It's the mental component that kills every alcoholic or drug addict. And it's because you can't let go of the thought that I need a drug or a drink right now. And I've said this often at meetings, and I've said it a few times here. The one thought that kills more addicts, alcoholics, but I also say compulsive golfers, is the idea that I know this is no good for me, so let me just do it one more time and I'll stop. And you never stop. That's the essence of clinging and maintaining. And again, I'm not just you. It's not just obvious addicts that are prone to this. Every human being does this, whether it's with something obvious like that or the next piece of chocolate cake or a brand new pair of shoes, whatever it is. Or the belief that as long as I keep the Ten Commandments, I'm good to go. I don't care what the quality of my life is right now. I don't care where I am, where I'm at. As long as I know I'm good to go when I'm dead, you stop living your life and you've lost your mind.
John, can you say at that point of clinging and maintaining that that's the equivalent of dukkha?
Boy, that's a good question. It's the maintenance of dukkha. And I would say dukkha is what results from ignorance. So that might not be a very satisfying answer. Dukkha really is the description of dependent origination, isn't it? Mm. And this is one aspect of dukkha. And it's that clinging and maintaining that is, you know, think about that a little more, because that really is the ongoing maintenance of ignorance and dukkha. So you could say, yeah, clinging and maintaining is dukkha.
And they only describe 10 steps. What are the two that they often exclude?
There's one that, so I can think of it, the nine. There's some that the Buddha is describing dependent origination in 9 and 10 steps, and it makes sense in relation to that context, but I just can't remember exactly why, which one is left out. I think it's, and now I got to go look.
It's not becoming a verse.
No, it's pretty tight. It might be self-identification and, I'm trying to think of where it goes from consciousness. I think it goes from consciousness to skips name and form, skips feeling, and I think it skips contact too, the 9-factor one. And goes from consciousness to clinging and maintaining, I think. But I could be wrong. Yeah, so now I know what I'm doing tonight. Thanks. let me just go back to one. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. And we know that what we're talking about in the context, this is one of those lines that has led to great speculation and given license to all kinds of fabrications in the non-dual vain. In the context of what we're talking about, it's obvious that becoming what? Becoming further ignorant. That this is the context. But people have taken that, and even this line is saying, well, the Buddha is describing somehow of becoming a physical human being, and he's describing a physical birth. And some people say that there's an inference that we have to have 3 births until we're actually a human being. Mm-hmm. I've read this Sutta 100 times. I never saw any of that. But the reason why I'm bringing that up is because it's that type of thinking that is necessary for someone who wants to take something that is completely dualistic, dependent origination, and make it non-dual, make it support that type of thinking. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming further ignorant. From becoming further ignorant as a requisite condition comes birth. And again, the Buddha is not talking about physical birth. Look at the context. He's talking about giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. That's the most important teachings of the Buddha on karma and rebirth. I won't get too deep into that right now. From birth as a requisite condition comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. It's the Buddha's description of dukkha. So I'm not going to read any more of the sutta. That describes the process that every human being goes through. And obviously, there's no... We're not looking for blame or responsibility except the self-responsibility to hopefully recognize this and extricate ourselves. From ignorance as a requisite condition comes stress and suffering is the common human condition. It's not describing my condition or your condition. It's describing everybody's condition. And so the resolution for that is a very clear way, a step-by-step and methodical way of recognizing as these fabricated, clingy, non-dual thoughts, including the thought that I need another piece of chocolate cake or the thought that I'm going to Tulsita heaven. And any variation in between must be recognized and abandoned, because any type of speculative, non-human establishment is contrary to the Dhamma. And again, this, when I talk about very powerful and subtle strategies, this is what I'm talking about. This is the most subtle strategy. It's the most subtle strategy that has gone unnoticed by a human population for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years, recognizing the foolishness of any type of establishment like this. Again, it's what even people that aren't religious, many people will talk about some kind of amorphous place where they're going to be after death. Almost everyone. Atheist, agnostic, non-believer, all have that subtle aspect of their thinking, even though they won't define it for themselves, because you can't define it for yourself. Go ahead and define heaven or Tulsita heaven or Amitabha heaven or the heaven of the 71 virgins or whatever. Try and describe it accurately. You can paint a picture of it, can't you? Can you? You can't. Wait a minute. You can paint a picture of it, but a picture isn't real. If it cannot be experienced by a human being in this lifetime, it's not something the Buddha taught, and it's not something we should be too concerned about. Now, if you're a person that wants to get into the physics of the universe, meaning study physics, that's fine. But it's not Dhamma practice. Studying the Four Noble Truths is not science. It's studying the Four Noble Truths. It could be. You can make it a scientific inquiry. But the whole notion that I can be anything other than what we learned about two classes ago. What did we learn two classes ago? Let's see how well you pay attention.
Six properties.
The six property person. And in that most significant sutta, the Buddha repeatedly, over and over and over again, said, recognize and abandon any speculative self-establishment. That's the key to that sutta. Each and every human being is made up of six properties and can be nothing more. Along the way, we can do just about anything we want with our lives, including awaken. And I would say that the most important thing we can do is awaken. Wrong.
But the hard part for most people is bring up the courage to really give up that lifeline that's out there.
The life, you mean the lifeline of your beliefs, your fabricated beliefs.
Yes.
That's the problem.
You know, I'm doing all this for what? To be what I already am?
Yeah.
You know, isn't there anything better?
Well, think about the motivation for most people to do that, though. Mm-hmm. I believe in that non-dual existence, so I can be anything other than what I am.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I do that for two reasons. One is I don't know who I am, but the little that I do know, I don't think much of.
Yeah.
And so let me go find a place where I can put up with. I mean, there's a saying that we live our whole lives. It doesn't matter how much suffering we have in our lives because we'll get the reward.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told that over and over again,
right.
And it wasn't good enough. I just couldn't accept it. I said,
yep.
"There's got to be more to life than this." And what I realize is there is more to life than this, and it's this.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's nothing else than this.
Yep. I still remember the disappointment when you know, I asked the priest, "What, you know, why are we here?" Well, we're here to
serve God.
Serve God and hopefully go to heaven.
Yep. Yep.
Really?
Yeah.
And I mean, I was 12, I think.
Well, I think I was 12 when I finally understood it, and I didn't think, "There's no way I can serve God."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was taught that guy, he don't like me anyway, or she don't like me, or they don't like me. Well, how do I know they don't like me? Because they said that, you know, at best you're going to purgatory for a couple million years.
Mm.
I'm describing something as to why it was so hard for me to accept this notion of non-duality presented through the Christian church. It was to me, it was brutal. It was a brutal teaching. And how could I accept it? Why would I want to accept it? It's hurtful to me, and it's hurt. And I remember thinking about this. My mother was the world's greatest mother. My mother was the most wonderful person. She never said a bad word about anybody. And I'm being told this as I'm 12 years old. I'm thinking, even she's got to go to purgatory?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it was just twisting my little mind up. How could this be? And I couldn't reconcile. Nobody can reconcile those beliefs. But at least it made me uncomfortable enough that, you know, by my late teens, I started looking for something a little different and found Buddhism. So important question. Thank you. Shall we go around? Let's go online first. Go around. I'm going to get to Larry first. Larry, how are you?
I'm good, John. How are you? Can you hear me?
Yeah. How do you like my new look?
I think it's very handsome.
Is it? Yeah. I was telling everybody, yeah. I got the replays of the Honeymooners behind here, so really good.
Yeah, and I saw it last week, and I thought it was handsome.
Oh, that's right. Good to see you tonight, my friend.
Thank you. It's good to see you too.
What do you think of tonight's? I realize this was the. Isn't this the sutta I asked you to look at about a year ago?
Yeah, I've looked at it, re-looked at it, looked at it again.
Oh boy!
And I don't normally zoom in here, but when I saw it was on tonight, I thought, well, maybe one more time.
Well, did you find it helpful at all?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No. It's just like anything, you know. It's when you just got to keep you got to keep studying it. You got to keep rereading it. You got to keep trying to penetrate what it means. It's not unlike, you know, how we reread something and then say to ourselves, oh, I don't remember seeing that the last time I read it.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of the Dhammas like that.
Yeah.
There's even a section in the Dhammapada where the Buddha says, without repetition, there's no Dhamma.
Yeah.
We have to keep doing it. So I'm so glad you joined us.
I think it's generally I think it's generally felt that this is one of the more difficult things to grasp.
You mean dependent origination?
Yeah. Well, this you know, lack, you know, the self topic.
Oh, it is, because it's right here in front of us. It's our own thoughts are about ourselves are reverberating against our views of self. That's what the Buddha described in the Gara Sutta. So yeah, that is the difficult part. Larry, I'm glad you joined us again. I hope you continue, though. It's always good to see you.
Good to see you too.
Excuse me. Sarah, how are you?
I'm well.
There you are.
So this one, I'm not connecting with it for some reason. I'm really struggling to connect with it, which means I'm probably caught in it.
Probably.
Somewhere. So I'm just listening on this one.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you joined us tonight, Sarah. Kevin, how are you? What's that, Sarah?
Sorry. Oh, well, I was just, if I can ask a question.
Oh, please. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Is the aspect of identification and of, I guess, of interrelation, and I guess I don't understand if we're not supposed to relate and not supposed to be connected, if we have to kind of renounce like family and organizations that we're part of and things like that in order to be free of the suffering?
Yeah, it's such a great question, Sarah. And a lot of people take that, even especially initially, that the implications of understanding the three marks of existence initially seems like annihilation. And you mentioned family. So not having a fabricated, ignorant view of your family is as freeing and helps establish a true family dynamic, because you're in that family now for the first time. It doesn't eliminate, ending your ignorance of Four Noble Truths doesn't mean you no longer have a family. In fact, it means that you'll be more mindfully present with your family. It has nothing to do with external conditions. It has all to do with the way you think about yourself in relation to your family. So let's just say for a scenario, you've loved your mother your whole life and you've hated your father your whole life. Rather than looking at the reason why you might have hatred and having an effective way of recognizing the fabrication in that and letting it go, not having this is you'll always be coming up against that. The point I'm trying to make is that through the Dhamma, your relationships with everyone will improve, including your family. You don't lose anything of any value. You don't even have to give anything up. What naturally happens is our lives tend to become simpler. But we don't lose the ability to have compassion for other people. In fact, that increases. So, but it's an important question, Sarah. Thank you. Did that help?
Yes, it did. Thank you.
Nice. Kevin, how are you?
Doing well, John. Appreciate this teaching. I liked how when I heard you say the subtleties of self-establishment are not recognized by the world or by your associations, since they are part of the world at large, and that is encompassed in the First Noble Truth. The world is rooted in ignorance, so it will support self-establishment that is rooted in ignorance without being recognized. And the only way out is in, as we're talking about, the Buddha's Dhamma is pointing us back to the cushion that we have to, you can subtly eye make in your world, in your family, in your organizations, everywhere. It's not going to be noticed. And you can do it out in another universe or non-physical realm too. But the Dhamma points you back here. If you want to solve it, it's right here. And that root of ignorance is, it's imperceptible to anyone but a Dhamma practitioner. That's why we do this, to uproot it from its primordial essence, which is ignorance. We are born with ignorance. It's a consequence of a human life. And the method of practice that's available is the Dhamma to provide the prescription for that ignorance. So I hope that helps. Thank you.
That was great. Helped a lot. Thank you, Kevin. Tim, how are you tonight?
John, everybody online, everybody at the class, hello.
Tim.
Hi, Tim.
Okay. Yeah, I've been having origination. You can spend weeks and weeks and weeks on it, right? I always go back. Yeah, thanks, Kevin, for that, because that's really it. That's it in a nutshell. So this process of dependent origination is the process of suffering.
Yep.
It is the steps of which we suffer. And it all starts from wrong view.
Yep.
It all starts, that chain of events, that chain starts from the wrong view. And I find it very interesting over the last few weeks, as I've been studying dependent origination, that from the craving and grasping, that grasping initiates that becoming, and that becoming, that's what creates that karma, that instant rebirth back into that suffering.
Yeah.
And if I may, John, one thing I'm still on my cushion thinking about, and I talked about it last week, and I'm not trying to go up the weeds here. Everybody that I talk to about dependent origination, we all get stuck on anatta. And if it means annihilation, how can it not be a self? And it's not about annihilation. It is recognition that you are human.
Yeah.
And when we recognize our existence, that's when consciousness is. Okay? So that opportunity of suffering is going to exist, just the mere fact that we know we exist. And that's why I've been very interested in the different parts of the mind, of the unconscious and the subconscious, and how they are like firewalls, and how they interplay. And some people are able to keep those firewalls intact where they don't interplay. Some people, they are wide open. They're wide open, and they're flowing in and out, and it can get overwhelming. And I think that's why we see all of us at many times where there's a reaction, right? There's from contact, there's that reaction. And then, of course, we want that to end. We have the aversion to a negative reaction. We have a desire to keep pleasant ones going. And so I'm going to say reconciliation again. I know you mentioned it before, and I know what you meant, and I thank you for it, but the Dhamma allows us through the Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path to reconcile, and the word you use is better, okay, but to fully integrate it, to understand the process of that suffering. And if we can see that process, we can maybe put that firewall back up, so we don't have that continue, that rebirth and that becoming and that rebirth and back to the dependent origination. I'm sorry for the long-winded description, but it's kind of how where I am with this.
That's great, Tim. You have it right on. And reconcile is the right. I mean, I use that word often. Reconciliation. It's a process of recognition renunciation, and which results in the reconciliation of the Dhamma, of all ignorant views. And you know, dependent origination now, to me, is the most, is just a simple and direct teaching. But it took me quite a few years of reading it, studying it, seeing how it fits, and teaching it to realize how simple it was. Because up until that time, it was, you know, what is this? You know, it was hard not to get into the weeds in it until you see it in the proper context. And that is, it's a very straightforward teaching. And in fact, it an understanding of dependent origination relieves that fear of annihilation, because we realize that we're just human beings. We can't, I mean, I could kill myself. I mean, you know, suicide is, any human being can engage in that. It's not a real good way to learn the Dhamma, though. I'm not laughing at suicide, but the point I'm making, we have two choices in the world. We can either awaken or not. And the fact that many people don't know they have that choice doesn't mean that it's not a valid choice. You know, this is all the reasons why people develop and or establish and maintain fabricated non-dual existences just for that, because they think that that's salvation for them. You know, we don't. At least most of us don't. Thank you, Tim. Josh, how are you tonight? Hey, Josh.
Hi, John. Hi, everybody.
Hey, John.
How are you?
Well, I'm doing good, but as usual, my mind is whirling. Kind of going along with what Tim said, I think my right brain and my left brain are in constant battle.
Yep.
And sometimes I get all bogged down in terminology,
and
non-duality is one of those. If non-duality is a some sort of belief in an afterlife or whatever, I'm not sure what duality is. And I kind of think it has something to do with the middle way, but I don't know quite where to put that. We're not extremely one way or the other way, but in the middle, and restraint is required for that.
Yep.
And I'm not sure how that all ties in. So that's all I got to offer tonight, John. Thank you.
That's a lot, though, Josh. The Buddha taught. The Buddha described the Eightfold Path as the middle way, meaning that it's almost always misunderstood. It simply means that the Eightfold Path provides a middle way path between extreme views that would otherwise be distracting. In this case, an extreme view would be a view of non-duality. Using the term non-duality doesn't mean or imply that there's either non-duality or duality, which would kind of mean that there's only one experience or only two experiences. What the Buddha taught is that there's no such thing as non-duality as it relates to the Dhamma. Everything is in its discreteness, in its discrete form. And by that, I mean, we stop seeing even a piece of chocolate cake in a personal way. It's just something. It's just an object in the world. Much like, I don't really care. I prefer Japanese maples, but an oak tree does just fine for me too. You see the difference? It's not. There's no ignorance involved. It's simply seeing things as they really are, which is in their discreteness. Everything arises of itself, of its own accord, and we're connected in a physical world by physical things, but that doesn't imply anything as connecting as far as the Dhamma is concerned. That's the only difference. And as far as annihilation, one of the major schools of Buddhism believes that it's that the moment you awaken, you poof, you just kind of explode and you vanish. Well, I mean, everybody's left, but I think that's the fourth largest type of Buddhism in the world. We laugh at it because it sounds silly, but millions of people believe that, and it's a belief because of the need to establish yourself somewhere. It sounds good, it feels good. Okay, I can do this, I can chant a lot, and then poof, I'm out of here. It's a perfect escape. And they overlooked the fact that Siddhartha Gautama awakened and he didn't vanish for another 45 years. He stayed right here and taught as a human being and taught the Dhamma. So the example of the Buddha's life is the perfect example of a non-dual belief. That letting go of that belief in non-duality freed his mind to become a Buddha, to become awakened. So, and that you're developing it, Josh. Yeah. Thank you. Who's left? That's just me. I don't want to talk to me. Did I miss anybody? I think I got everyone. Okay. Matt, how are you?
Hey, John. Good to see you. Good to see everybody here. Glad everyone's here that's here. Really enjoying this discussion. I'm just going to take noble silence today.
It's good to see you, man. David, how are you?
Well, John. The beauty of our practice is from the first moment you decide to come and join the Sangha, there's benefit.
Yeah.
And the immersion is your decision as a layperson, because you're in the world, and it's a big decision how much you're going to immerse yourself. And the more you immerse yourself, the more you move away from the intellectual and the experience. And someone who's been doing it for a lifetime has that same benefit as the first time that somebody starts.
Yeah.
And it's just that right effort and pushing away some of the things that get you in the weeds and just trust that this experience that I get to see Matt and I get to see Ram and I get to see Kate, it's all beneficial to the process. So. Thank you.
Thank you. Well said. Brett, how are you?
Good. Good to be here. Thanks for the teaching.
My pleasure.
I could go along with this one for a while. It's just where I'm at right now. You know, I guess with the thinking and stuff and being addicted to it, and it's been a challenge for me for a long time. And if it's, you know, if it's not trying to succeed in some area of my life, it doesn't work anymore because I've burnt that area out. And now I'm left with my kind of thinking. And it's a challenge. It's the most challenging probably time of my life and for a long time, abandoning views and not getting caught in the whole thing and negative thinking and stuff like that. I guess right effort is how I would probably, you know, keep on sitting on the cushion and, you know, putting yourself around people that are good people and keep on trying to, you know, work at it. And it's a challenge, but, you know, there's only one way, and that is to awaken. And it's just training myself to awaken.
Yeah.
And it's it.
I couldn't say it any better, Brett. You know? So listen to this every now and then and follow your advice. So, and also you're noticing the benefits of this along the way, though. You know, your right effort is paying off, correct?
Yeah. I've been working very hard.
You have.
So, I mean, after I realized that, like, you know, I got burned out with work and that was the only thing that was kind of holding me up. And then so now it's the thing on top of my shoulders that is the challenge here.
And you're being gentle with yourself?
Yes.
Good.
Yeah.
That's the key. Yeah. Thank you, my friend. I'm glad you joined. Kate, it's good to see you.
Good to be here. I'm just trying to absorb what I'm hearing. And the thing that sticks with me from last week about dependent origination is the story that I tell. It's not the truth.
Yeah.
It's just the story that I tell.
Mm-hmm.
Tell myself. And I can always change the story to be more accurate. So I think that's all I'm gonna say. I'm still, it's a lot to think about.
Yeah. Thank you, Kate. There is a lot to think about, but that's why I say often, we have to be very gentle with ourselves and with the practice. You get it, you know. You know yourself that you've developed a much deeper understanding of the Buddha's Dhamma than you ever had before. And now it's just a matter of, like Brett said, continued right effort and continue to integrate the practice itself. Mm-hmm. A lot of these answers, just, they fall into place. You know, I can describe what it feels like or other people in the Sangha, but you really don't know it until you know it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's possible. I mean, that's the best thing about the Dhamma is you get to know it. You know, you get to have this experience. You don't have to take anything on faith, but you can take some direction to get there. And that's really what a teacher's role. And the structure of the Dhamma is about that too. So I'm glad you joined tonight. Michael, how are you?
Good, John. Hello, everybody. Hey, Brett, just a shout out to you, man. I've been listening to your commentary, man. I really think you hit the nail on the head a lot of times. So I think if you're questioning yourself, I think you're evolving pretty good with it, you know?
Thank you. Thanks.
Good work. And I agree with Brett, actually, on the just practicing and understanding and just keep on doing the work, you know. Nothing comes without, you know, I'll use, you know, the word immersion. I'm immersing yourself in this. So that's where the, you know, that's what helps me and enjoying myself. I think a key to all that goes on here is the recognition of what anatta is, recognizing it as the not self, and as the not self, and it gives us perspective in relation to now we have the aggregates. So the aggregates are anatta; they're not self. So I think that perspective lets us know that we're not this shroud of a being that we truly identify with. So that understanding and that concept, and then the way the interplay between anatta, anicca, and dukkha, you know, work together, that also gives you perspective, and that perspective is right for you. Okay.
Yep.
Further on that, like that again. Right view comes from having the mind and the body united. Noticing distractions and realizing that we are not the distractions and the fabrications that we create. It should almost set up like a red flag when we're fabricating or we're distracted, and our mind and our body are not together. They're not in one place and in a being in the moment. Yeah. So. That's just about all I want to do. And just the other fact of the matter is that we do have the choice. It's up to us. We have choice that when we're going through, when we're going through our days, we have a choice to end that ignorance at any time, at point of contact. What's going to be our next response to life unfolding before us?
Yeah.
What's it going to be? So I think when you understand anatta, its relationship to the aggregates, and then three marks of existence, I think there's a disenchanted view of things occurs, and then dispassion arises, and we can see things clearer,
mm-hmm.
much clearer, when we have that, when we understand the interplay, and we can understand anatta and the aggregates.
Thank you, Michael. The anatta is simply described, and it's the best way to think of it, is anatta means wrong views of self. It's not a mystery. You know, it doesn't lead to, okay, I accept the fact that anatta means wrong views of self, but what is a self? Because it's really two separate things, isn't it? As far as Dhamma practitioners, our 37 class study of true Vipassana, Vipassana is not some, as the Buddha teaches, is not some modern hybrid meditation technique. True Vipassana means insight, introspective insight into the three marks of existence, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. And that central thing is where the Dhamma resides, within each and every human being, within me. That's where I practice the Dhamma. And so as far as changing that, the only thing I need to know is not what is the self, the Buddha teaches that very clearly, is to understand and accept the fact that anatta means that the views I'm holding of a self are wrong views. Let go of the views. They're not a self. That's, and there can be no more clear and unambiguous explanation, but it's very difficult for a self rooted in ignorance to accept that. But it is just that. Thank you for bringing that up. Julia, good to see you.
Good to see you, John. Good to see everyone. John, I really enjoyed reading this commentary because it kind of, for me, it linked everything together.
Yeah.
It, you know, the aggregates, you know, dependent origination is interwoven in everything. It's in the Four Noble Truths. It's in the Eightfold Path. I like the way you put it all together. It formed a picture for me.
Good.
That made me have a greater understanding.
Yeah.
You know, so I just want to mention that.
Thank
I really
you.
Enjoyed reading it a lot. I wrote all sorts of notes all over it. I just wanted to explain a very simple experience I had with dependent origination. Because I've recognized even more so because of all the knowledge you give us, you know, and also doing jhana, that helps also. But I seem to be catching myself, but sometimes not quick enough. The other day I was listening to music, you know, 80s music. So of course, you know, this is like now the past. And so, you know, how music transports you into the past.
Yeah.
So I was listening to the song, and then next thing you know, a feeling arose in me, and I started to realize that I started to like cling to something in the past. I started to cling to the person I was like 30 something years ago, like 30, more than 35 years ago, to this person in the
yeah.
past. And I started to realize, and so I immediately took off the music, and I took a breath, and I said, okay, why is restraint? And I started to tell myself, okay, well, that was one of the clinging, that's the, I'm going
yeah.
through the dependent origination, that's clinging, and no, you know, I stopped myself. I said, why is restraint? Why? But it was really funny, because Michael walks in, and I says, I just had this experience with, you know, dependent origination, so I'm starting to tell him, my mind is so quick. It's funny how you
yeah.
go so quickly and you start flipping through. You start to realize that you're, you know, I have to be gentle with myself, because I always remember you saying that, because I was harsh at first. I said, I let myself go again. How could I let that happen? And I said, oh, no, I should be gentle with myself, because I have a tainted view of the world. I'm not yet fully realized. I'm still ignorant, still fabricating. Still have this dormant mind, you know, this consciousness, and so it's easy for you to flip through the, you know, the whole scale of dependent origination in an instant, you know, and that's
yeah.
how I realized how fast it was. Before I realized it, you know, I was already clinging, and so it was just, that's where I had to release everything. But it took a lot, you know, it took a lot of my own effort to realize, because you know, you start going along, and the next thing you know, you've gone through the process already.
Yeah.
So,
Julia,
I just wanted to explain that, because I thought, I know everyone thinks it's like maybe it's very complex, but it's very simple. It's a simple thing that happens instantaneously through all experiences on a daily basis. And, you know, the only way to eliminate is to further do jhana
yeah.
and actually learn the knowledge, because with the knowledge, it does help. It helps you to recognize
yeah.
what your mind is going through. So, I don't know if that helps anybody, but
that helps a lot. Right? I mean, it was a perfect description of refined mindfulness and right effort. So thank you, Julia.
Yeah, thank you, John.
And it is, you hear me say it, there's proof. I've said it over and over again for many years. It's simple, but it's not easy, is it? What I used to say, it's a practice of ease and joy, but it's not for the faint of heart. And I think that's true. But all we have to do is what we do. We don't have to do anything more or develop it any faster than we're able to do it. And the only thing that we need to do to ensure that we'll reach the culmination of the path is continue with right effort. And it really is just that simple. You know, keep doing it. And whenever we find ourselves stuck in our imagination about something, now we recognize it. And we can remind ourselves that whatever it is, a piece of chocolate cake, center field for the Yankees, or establishment until seat to heaven, to remind ourselves, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. And peace will prevail, peace and understanding. So, but a great class again. I'll get an email out to everyone, I think, but about our WAN weekend. It's going to be August 7th. And if anybody's interested, just get back to me. It's going to be an informal weekend. I'm not even calling it a retreat, although we'll have some sessions. But if you want to join us, let me know.
John, how many days is that?
Friday through Sunday.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. We'll finish with metta, as we always do. There it is. So again, find your meditative posture. Gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth. Take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.